I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. A climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western U.S., according to a new study from a group of Columbia University scientists. The study, which is based on modern weather observations, 1,200 years of tree ring data, and dozens of climate models, appeared last month in the leading journal Science. It found that the period from 2000 through 2018 was the driest 19-year span since the late 1500s. One of today's guests, Benjamin Cook, a NASA climate scientist and co-author of the study, says an important lesson coming out of this research is that climate change is not a future problem. It is a problem today. So what are the implications of a mega drought for the West, and what can be done to prevent it? Benjamin Cook is an adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University and a research physical scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. And Benjamin Cook is co-author of this study. Hi, Dr. Cook. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're also joined by Jay Lund, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis, a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, and a frequent contributor to CaliforniaWaterBlog.com. Hi, Professor Lund. Thank you so much for joining us. And Jim Robbins is a veteran journalist based in Helena, Montana. Jim's latest book is The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. Jim Robbins wrote a five-part series on the water-starved Colorado River for Yale Environment 360. Jim has also written for the New York Times and other publications. Hi, Jim. Thanks for coming back. Nice to have you. Well, I want to start off with you, Dr. Cook, a very basic question. What is the difference between a drought, because we in California have experienced many droughts, between a drought and a mega drought?
Yeah, when we talk about a mega drought, what we're usually talking about are events that, you know, could persist for 20, 30, 40 years. You know, these were droughts that we see happening in the western U.S. about 1,000 years ago, and these are events that are much more persistent than any of the kind of classic or historical droughts that we see in the western U.S., like the Dust Bowl or the 1950s drought in the Southwest. And so, you know, this most recent event is starting to kind of push into what we might consider a mega drought. And if it does, then it kind of makes it kind of the first mega drought of the modern era.
Can you talk more about what changes we will see? I mean, from a very basic level, when it doesn't rain, we hear about issues in the Central Valley. We hear about farming issues, for example. And so, you know, for people who are not scientists or people who don't have that much knowledge about what a drought really means, that kind of gives us an example of a drought. And obviously, it gets a lot of media attention. But what are some of the other changes that happen during a mega drought?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, water is really the kind of foundation of pretty much everything that people and ecosystems are doing, especially in the western U.S. And so, you know, a mega drought just means those sorts of impacts are just going to be even bigger than you would see during a shorter drought. So it means bigger impacts on groundwater, on stream flow, on snow, more drought-stressed vegetation, bigger impacts on agriculture, and just bigger challenges overall to meet the water demands and needs of people living throughout the region.
And Professor Lund, what would you add? What do we need to know about the difference between droughts and mega droughts?
Well, I think there is some pretty big differences in the sense that a long drought, some of these mega droughts he has of about 19 to more than 100 years, it really changes people's expectations for what they want out of water and what they can get out of water in a region. So if you have droughts that are lasting for more than 19 years, say, it changes the kind of cropping patterns that farmers will want to have, because they'll start thinking, well, maybe I can't have this orchard crop survive very well with this diminished amount of water. So it has a lot of changes for people in their expectations.
And Dr. Cook, reading the study, it says that a mega drought is emerging in the western United States. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean exactly?
I mean, what we meant really was that this ongoing drought in the western United States that's been happening in some form since 2000, you know, is starting to push the bounds of what we consider a mega drought, an event that's, you know, 20 years or longer. And, you know, what we're really seeing is we're seeing a long-term drought event that's developed that, you know, really looks different than many of the more recent droughts that we've seen in the western U.S., including like the 1950s drought or the Dust Bowl. And so, you know, that's all primarily due to climate change, which has kind of pushed what would normally have been just a kind of regular drought into a really extreme and in some ways unprecedented event.
How do you find out what drought conditions were like in the past and how they have changed over time?
So we use tree rings. Obviously, we don't have rain gauges that go back or instrumental records that go back 1,000 years. But we have lots of trees across the western United States, and these trees are very sensitive to how much water is available. During wet years, they grow very well. During dry years, they grow very poorly. And what we can do is we can use the patterns of growth in the tree rings to basically back out or estimate what drought variations would have been, you know, over the last 1,000 years. And because trees are so long-lived, it really allows us to look much further back in the past than we could with just instrumental observations.
You actually looked at 1,200 years of tree ring data?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the western U.S. is the kind of one of the best places to do this kind of research because there are lots of trees, conifers, bristlecone pines, that do live hundreds of years and in some cases even more than 1,000 years. And so it gives us a way to really get an unprecedented understanding of what water looks like in the region.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And then you also looked at dozens of climate models and modern weather observations.
Yeah, I mean, what we really tried to do was connect what we see happening in the past with the tree rings to what's happening now in the observations to what could be happening in the future with the climate models. And we could also use the climate models to estimate, really, how much of this current event, this current drought, was due to climate change versus just natural variations in the climate system.
How many scientists worked on this, and how much time did you all spend on it?
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, I mean, there's quite a few of us, and we've been working on it in some capacity for probably the last 3 years, you know, building the whole analysis from the ground up to really, what we wanted to do was really provide a really comprehensive analysis of this event, you know, incorporating all the information that we have available from trees, observations, and climate models.
So what really struck you, I mean, this is an ongoing study, of course, but what really struck you about the latest research that you all uncovered?
I think the thing that really struck us was how strong the climate change signal is. You know, if we look at this event from 2000 to 2018, about 30 to 50% of the magnitude of this drought, or the severity of this drought, is attributable to climate change. And that's a very, very big proportion. And so that kind of surprised us. And this is what kind of, you know, is driving my own kind of, you know, argument that, you know, this event really represents that, or points out that climate change is a problem happening right now. It's not just some kind of theoretical future problem, but it's something that we need to start dealing with, you know, right now.
Right. Professor Lund, what was your reaction to the study and what really stood out for you?
Well, I thought it was an excellent study. It brought together a lot of different threads that have been sort of circulating around in the water community for over 20 years and brought them together very nicely and then looked forward very nicely. The point about the warmer temperatures magnifying the effects of normal droughts to make them much more severe, I think, is probably the major thing that was reinforced by this study.
That is Jay Lund, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis, a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, and a frequent contributor to CaliforniaWaterBlog.com. Benjamin Cook is an adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, and a research physical scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. Benjamin Cook is co-author of the new study. A group of Columbia University scientists have been working on this for 3 years. They found that a climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western United States. And now I think we have Jim Robbins with us. Jim is a veteran journalist based in Helena, Montana. Jim wrote a beautiful book, The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. He also wrote an incredible five-part series on the Colorado River for Yale Environment 360. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Jim. Jim, what was your reaction to this study, and what really stands out for you?
Well, I'm not surprised. This kind of warning has been taking place the last few years, and this is the latest salvo in a barrage of studies and warnings that have come from the scientific community to say, you know, we may be headed into something for which we have no analog in the past. And so how are we going to handle this? And I hope that the policymakers are listening. I know some of them are. And I think that we really need to start thinking about how we can make the Western United States more resilient to deal with this. It may be wrong in a sense to think of this as a drought. When we think of a drought, we think of something that goes away eventually. But past studies have shown, or at least one past study I know of, that this may be the new normal, that this isn't going to go away. And we're going to have to learn to live with this for the foreseeable future. And so how are we going to make adjustments to how we use water and how much water we use in the future?
Jim, as a veteran journalist who writes about issues like water and droughts, how do you, when a study like this comes out, how do you explain the urgency in your pieces to your readers and really explain to people what this actually means?
Well, you try and get the scientists to speak in as pithy way as possible about what the threats are. I mean, I think that's what journalists do, is they are able to talk to scientists. And sometimes reports like this are urgent, but they are couched in a scientific language that doesn't necessarily speak to the average person. And so what our job as journalists is to do is to read it and to talk to the scientists and get them to kind of say in more plain English, if you will, exactly what we're up against. And I think the word mega drought really covers that in some ways. But then to say, well, what do we do about it? Where do we go from here? And what kinds of solutions are there? And there are solutions. No one should think that this is throw up their hands and say, oh, God, we don't know what we're going to do. I mean, people are working on solutions now. I've been working on a story about that. And, you know, there's reason for hope. Of course, the big solution for this is to take climate change seriously and reduce our carbon, which everyone I talk to says the biggest solution for this mega drought, and other scientists have said the same, is to reduce our carbon in the atmosphere and reduce warming.
And we'll talk about solutions throughout the show. I'd like to give the phone number out to listeners because, you know, if you have any questions about droughts, the differences between droughts and mega droughts, and I think that based on where we live and if you're directly affected by this or if you read about it regularly, it probably affects people in a very different way. So what are your thoughts about, you know, we've heard about California droughts, or if you live in another state, what questions do you have about what mega droughts actually mean? As Jim said, there are solutions out there, which we will also talk about. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. And you can read the findings of the study that's been conducted by Columbia University scientists over the past couple of years, and they have found that a climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western United States. Dr. Cook, what are your thoughts about really getting the word out to the public to talk about just how serious a mega drought really is?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mean, I think it's important. And again, I agree with the previous caller, but our panelist, that this is again the sort of place where, professional science communicators and journalists are really valuable for, not only kind of helping to translate the science, but also connecting the science to more kind of specific impacts that people at a local level might just get in a more visceral way, rather than kind of more general discussion about, the entire, Western United States. I think that's a kind of key thing to do is to connect these big, large scale events to people's own kind of personal experiences.
Professor Lund, what would you add?
Well, I think we've had a lot of conversations, and we will be having a lot more conversations about climate change and its effects on many aspects of our lives and our livelihoods and the environment. What's really important, I think, to move forward in these discussions is to move them back into the practical realm of, okay, well, what should we do about these? What kind of activities make sense to do about these things, and what kinds of activities don't make sense? Because there's quite a lot of things that will not be very useful in managing with mega droughts or other forms of climate change.
Well, I feel like when we do these shows about climate change, we tend to end the show by talking about solutions, but lately we've been flipping it around just because there's so much happening around climate change now and the climate crisis. So, Jim, since you brought up solutions, why don't we talk about some of those?
Well, some of the things I've heard, some of the things that are taking place and some are proposed. I mean, agriculture uses most of the water. And I mean, of course, the big solution is to reduce CO2 into the atmosphere, which will eventually help reduce the rate of drying and warming. But on a more immediate level, in terms of water, because a mega drought is not just about water, it's about forests and natural systems out there that will. I mean, I wrote a piece recently about heat stress in wildlife, and a lot of species now are beyond the envelope of which they thrive, and it's gotten so hot. And so, we're going to see species perhaps dying out. We are seeing forests dying and retreating. We may see state shift, where you have forests that over a period of years becomes prairie or becomes desert because no longer can sustain itself because there's not enough moisture. But then on a more immediate level, as far as water goes, some of the things that are going on agriculture consumes most of the water from the Colorado River and other rivers, and 80%, I think, is the number on the Colorado River. And so they are reducing the water they use. They're switching in some – alfalfa is probably the single biggest user of water on the Colorado River, and people are switching – in some places from alfalfa to orchards, which pay more and which use microjets, use a lot less water, little tiny sprinklers that just water right around the tree rather than flood irrigating with alfalfa. And you lose a lot to precipitation or to evapotranspiration. There are cities out there that some people claim that cities like San Diego and Albuquerque and Phoenix have decoupled from their growth from water. That means that they no longer need to, they've saved so much water, conserved so much water, that they can still keep growing and not use any more water because so much water has become available through things like, cash for grass, which pays people to take out their lawn. In San Diego, they're going to be doing what's called toilet-to-tap recycling, although I think they have another name for it now. But it's taking water that comes out of the treatment plant, the sewage treatment plant, and gets recycled into drinking water quality. They've built a desalinization plant in San Diego. There's another one going in, I think, at Huntington in California. So these are – and actually desalinization is – emerging as a global solution in places like Israel, Australia, and California, and in Texas, because It's expensive, but water is getting so expensive these days, it's now emerging as a viable alternative.
Hmm. Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean by water is getting so expensive now?
Well, it's expensive, the power it takes to pump water from the Colorado River to San Diego, for example. It makes it expensive to pump the water. Same with Phoenix. As the cost of power goes up and other costs go up, then as the cost of desal comes down, although it's still expensive, it starts to even out, because cities need to, if they want to keep their economy intact, they need to pay for water, and so they're also finding ways to pay for it. So it's becoming, you know, we've heard for years it was going to be the solution, and it's slow, and but it's coming.
Dr. Cook, what solutions would you add to Jim's list?
Yeah, I mean, the solutions, you know, Sear is a little bit outside of my own kind of, you know, realm of expertise, but you know, as he says, and I think a really important point he makes is that there are a lot of solutions, right? I mean, what we've seen emerge from the drought of the last, you know, 19 years is kind of, in many ways, kind of newfound, you know, cooperation and collaboration, you know, within states and across states to, you know, conserve water and to revisit water sharing agreements and to better manage the existing resources. And so, you know, really, there's lots of solutions and there's lots of potential things that can be done. The only real losing move is to pretend that climate change is not happening and it's not going to be a problem.
Professor Lund, what would you add?
Well, you know, with all these kinds of big changes, and I think we see it with the current pandemic, we're always most productive if we're someplace between complacency and panic. You know, we need a little bit of a hint of panic just to motivate us and get us out of our lethargy. But if we're complacent, we don't really get the things done that need to be done. So you want to do some serious analysis and see what makes sense. In terms of solutions for this, these mega droughts, when we've done modeling of this, what we see is a tremendous reduction in irrigated agriculture. When we modeled the mega drought, what we saw was about a 50% reduction in the use of water for irrigation.
Professor Lund, did we lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
So about 50% reduction in the use of water for irrigation under a very severe mega drought for California, as well as some water marketing, selling some of that water from agriculture to cities, a little bit of ocean desalination, but not very much because, as the caller panelist said, it's very expensive. Quite a lot of water conservation. So agriculture and the environment are really the areas that are most severely affected by these mega droughts, and not so much the rest of the economy. 95% of the economy can pretty much chug along.
Professor Lund, since you brought up desalinization, we have a listener question. Elizabeth writes, can you tell us more about desalination? How does it work? What are the drawbacks and unintended consequences?
The major technology now for ocean water desalination is called reverse osmosis. And it has a very fine membrane, and you force water through the membrane, which separates the salt out from the water. The membrane is so fine that the salt molecules can't make it through. It's very energy intensive, and there's some thermodynamic limits to how efficient that can be. So the cost of that will always be fairly high just for operating costs. The unintended sort of negative consequences of it can be, aside from the cost and the high energy use, what do you do with the salt after you've taken the water out of the salt? And in inland areas, this can become quite a problem.
Does anyone else have comments on that one?
Yeah, the other drawback from desal plants is that they take in a lot of collateral sea life. They cause a lot of damage. These giant intakes suck water in through screens, and they end up sucking a lot of organisms from, shellfish to fish and all kinds of things, and small fish, and they end up killing them. And that's a huge problem, and they're trying to solve that, but it's a real impact.
Well, thank you for the question, Elizabeth. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are talking about a new study from a group of Columbia University scientists. They found that a climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western United States. We're joined by Benjamin Cook, adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, Jay Lund, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis, and Jim Robbins, a veteran journalist based in Helena, Montana. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with award-winning journalist Gerald Posner about his new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. How can we ensure that Big Pharma does not hike prices and restrict access for COVID-19 treatments and a vaccine? On Wednesday, Dr. Dina Grayson will be back to take your questions about testing, contact tracing, and a nationwide plan that is still needed. Thursday, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich will take your questions about the current state of the economy and the changes that are needed. Today, it's our One Planet series. We're talking about a new study from a group of Columbia University scientists. They found that a climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western U.S. We're joined by Jim Robbins, a veteran journalist, author of The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. And I hope you can take some time to read Jim's five-part series on the water-starved Colorado River. He wrote it for Yale Environment 360. Jay Lund is professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis, a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, and a frequent contributor to CaliforniaWaterBlog.com. Benjamin Cook is adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia and a research physical scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, and he's co-author of the study. And you can join us at 866-798-8255 if you have any questions about water, about droughts and a mega drought. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Dr. Cook, is there a consensus among scientists about what a mega drought is?
There's no real formal definition. Again, it's been very used generally in a very ad hoc way to refer to these drought events in the western U.S. from 1,000 years ago that were persistent for 20, 30, 40 years. Much longer than, you know, many of the historical droughts like the Dust Bowl. You know, here we used it because, you know, what we found in our study was that, you know, climate change is making this current ongoing drought resemble much more like those big mega droughts than what we might consider a more stereotypical, you know, drought from the last 100 years.
And if this continues, what changes can we expect to see in a state like California?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the longer the drought, you know, goes, then the more persistent and, you know, in some cases maybe irreversible many of the impacts, you know, actually are. You know, we know, for example, that during some of these worst mega droughts from 1,000 years ago, there were rivers in the Sierra Nevadas that were dry for 100 years. You know, we know that the kind of current drought is having really big effects on forest mortality and trees and species and also agriculture. And so, you know, the longer it goes on, especially for natural ecosystems, the longer and the more persistent those impacts are likely to be.
Mm. Professor Lund, what would you add? What changes are we likely to see if this continues?
Well, we had a recent drought, 2012 to 2016, it was only 4 or 5 years, but it had tremendous impacts, certainly on the forest ecology and aquatic ecosystems, as well as got us to rethink managing groundwater in the state. If we have had a drought that went much longer than that, I think it would more profoundly affect what we expect out of our system, what kinds of water infrastructure and water management and water policies we have. You know, and particularly, I think it's going to be difficult on the environmental management side.
Jim, since you wrote a lengthy piece about the Colorado River, what changes do you expect to happen there. As you write, the Colorado River and its tributaries provide water to nearly 40 million people for municipal use, supply water to irrigate 5.5 acres of land, and is the lifeblood for at least 22 native tribes.
Well, I think one of the big impacts beyond the impacts I mentioned earlier is going to be on agriculture. Imperial Valley in California is called America's Salad Bowl, because so much lettuce and other crops are grown there. And if there's not enough water, they're the biggest user of Colorado River water. And if Colorado River water gets low enough, if the reservoirs get low enough, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, then we may not be able to sustain the agricultural industry the way that it is now. They've made a lot of gains in using less water, but it just depends on how far the crisis goes. I mean, if we have many years without snow or with very little snow in Colorado, which is Colorado's kind of the reservoir. The snow on the mountains is a reservoir for the flow in the Colorado River all the way down to Mexico. And Mexico, too, by the way, south of the border, is also a salad bowl. And farms that have flown over that area, and the farms are just bumper to bumper, as far as the eye can see, all with Colorado River water. And if there isn't enough water, we could see those areas struggle to grow enough food for everyone. The other part of this, by the way, is as water gets scarcer, surface water, people are pumping more groundwater, and it's not well monitored. A lot of people don't know. And I got a call when the series came out. I got a call from a guy who runs think tank in Michigan, I think, and they've been studying the gravitational pull of groundwater for 30 years. And what they do is they have a satellite, and it looks at the southwest, and they can see, and they measure the gravitational pull of the water, and the heavier it is, the more gravitational pull there is, and it's getting less and less. Now, you can't measure groundwater, you can't see it, but this is one way of sensing it, and what they're saying is no one's talking about the fact that as we run out of surface water, groundwater is diminishing as well, because people are pumping more of it without knowing how much they're pumping or how much they're using. So it's a serious problem.
Yeah, very serious. Dr. Cook, we've done shows about this, what's happening in the Central Valley. I'm just reading that right now from Science Magazine. California's Central Valley is sinking. During a recent intense drought from 2012 to 2016, parts of the valley sank as much as 60 centimeters per year. This is evidence of a slow motion disaster, the result of the region's insatiable thirst for groundwater. Can you talk about that, Dr. Cook?
Yeah, I mean, groundwater is a special problem, right? So, you know, it's this great resource for when you're in a drought and you don't have the surface water available. But there are a few different problems, right? So, you know, one is, you know, as Issa said, we don't know, for most of these aquifers, we don't know how much is actually in there. So we can keep pumping and pumping it, but we don't know, you know, if there's another 20 years left or 30 years left, or if we're really starting to run it down. The other issue that we get into, like happening in the Central Valley, is that if you pump too much, then you can actually start to collapse the aquifer. And that's that sinking that in that study that you were just referring to. And that basically starts to inhibit or even destroy the capacity of those aquifers to recharge the next time you have some wet years. And so you're kind of, you know, drawing out all that groundwater without, you know, or overdrawing it to the point where now you're inhibiting your ability in the future to rely on that resource during another drought period. And so, you know, with climate change, as these drought events get more severe and longer and more frequent, it's likely that many areas will rely more on groundwater, and without a kind of careful management plan in place, then, you know, we could run the risk of using up those resources in a very fast fashion.
Dr. Cook, what are your thoughts about the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which became law in September 2014? And this is really forcing, you know, counties, farmers, native tribes, I mean, so many people to rethink groundwater policies. And there's just a lot of tension around this law. What are your thoughts about how this is going to play out?
I mean, that's hard for me to say. I mean, I can't really speak to the efficacy of the law or how people are, reacting to it. But, I do think groundwater more generally does need to be better regulated, because, if it's not, then it's, in a lot of cases, it becomes this kind of first come, first serve thing. We have a lot of individuals out there who are just going to grab it, as quickly as they can and use it without thinking about kind of longer term issues and the fact that, this water should be kind of available for lots of people to use as we move forward.
Right. Professor Lund, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, groundwater is tremendously important, especially for shorter droughts. When you get to mega droughts of 20 years or longer, you don't get through a mega drought with groundwater. There's not enough of it. We're not exactly sure how much there is, but we're sure enough about how much there is to know that we can't get through 100 years of a drought with groundwater. So it's very important that we regulate groundwater, and with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, we're moving pretty well in that direction. It's going to be very difficult and awkward, but at least we're moving in the right direction.
Professor Lund, when it comes to managing water in a massive state like California, what are your thoughts about a lot of people, this Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is a huge deal, but as I said, there's a lot of tension around what sort of changes will be implemented. What are your thoughts about other changes that need to happen in terms of, how California manages water?
Well, I think we have four major areas of problems, water problems for California, all of which have some involvement with climate change. I think the first, perhaps, is groundwater. The big three to me, the hard three to me, are groundwater, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and environmental management. How do we manage ecosystems, particularly with climate change, but also in this very dry climate that we have? And then a fourth one, which I think is an easier problem if we get organized, is rural groundwater safety.
Sure, go ahead, Jim.
One thing. Well, I think one of the things we've overlooked is also the impacts on endangered species. Pardon?
That's the environment.
Right. But specifically, I don't mean you. I mean, in our discussion is that 90% of biodiversity in the desert occurs within a mile of the rivers, and as these rivers dry up, and we still continue to pump groundwater, which causes them to dry up even faster, that you might see species pushed over the edge. It's just they're critical lifelines for a lot of different species in the Southwest, and a lot of them are very small. You almost jump across them, so it doesn't take much to kind of drain them or render them not as efficient in helping maintain endangered species.
Well, we have a number of questions from listeners. Today on Your Call, we are talking about a new study from a group of Columbia University scientists, and it found that a climate-driven mega drought is emerging in the western United States. We're joined by Jim Robbins, a veteran journalist based in Helena, Montana, Jay Lund, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis, and Benjamin Cook, adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. He's one of the co-authors of the study. Alicia writes, the Prime Minister of New Zealand has written a beautiful poem about the lesson of the COVID virus being that we can limit our use of cars and limitless consumption. We've all noticed the difference in air quality during this time. Do your guests believe that the public is ready for enforced limits on resource use, such as water for irrigation, for example? Jim, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, COVID is really, asking people to really make some changes here. Well, I guess forcing, because we don't have a choice, but it's making people really think about what we buy, what we do on a regular basis. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, COVID is a giant wild card in all this. I mean, if it hammers the economy the way some economists say it's going to, I think it may bring new homes and new commercial real estate in the Southwest to a near halt for a while. I mean, everyone I've talked to, things I've read, say no one really knows what to expect. But you know, someone told me during the interviewing for my series on Colorado River water is that when the first visitor to Las Vegas turns on the tap and no water comes out, that it's going to be near panic. And I think that it may take that kind of a thing for people to really change. No one wants to give up their water. That's just tantamount to giving up your livelihood, whether it's a city needs it for growth or it's agriculture. But it just may be forced upon us. I mean, unfortunately, that may be what it takes to make people are taking it seriously, but I don't think they're taking it seriously enough.
Hmm. Professor Lind, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think we're seeing quite a lot of improvements in water management over time. And certainly California, it's always very dynamic how we manage water. But we're seeing a lot of it, I think, in terms of the price of water. We've had some water market activity that's been very helpful in sort of signaling to everybody that water is now much more valuable than we used to think of it. And people are behaving appropriately. They're using less water. Certainly urban areas across the state, per capita water use is going down for several years, decades now. And this is a national trend. So I think as people become impressed with this growing scarcity, they'll use less, particularly because they'll see the prices going up.
Anything to add, Dr. Cook?
Yeah, I mean, I mostly, agree with Jay, and I'm actually reasonably, hopeful, because I think there's lots of, ways that we've dealt with this, water in the past, and by better pricing water to reflect its true value, I think, that encourages people, particularly in water in water scarce, areas like the Western U.S. to value it a little bit more and to use less water. I think another potential opportunity is to, potentially do a better job of taking advantage of the really of the wet years, right? So even in the future with climate change, you're going to get years that are wet, and very likely we'll get a few years here and there that are really, really wet. And so, if there's ways that we can take advantage of that, either through, for example, targeted recharge of aquifers and groundwater banking, that's another, potential opportunity to help kind of increase resiliency and increase resources that could be used during the dry times.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the email, Alicia. This is actually a great show idea. So we will definitely dedicate an entire show to the questions that you raised. Thank you for that. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I wish I had some optimism about these changes taking place quickly enough, but I'd like to ask your guests, what kind of timetable are they working on in terms of how quickly this kind of thing has to be turned around, water use, et cetera? I'd be very surprised if we were able to do something in the next 5 or 10 years, despite the fact that water's price may go through the roof. I just don't see it happening. And I'll just give you one example. It's somewhat related, but a different sort of issue, and that is this. When cigarette smoking was finally realized to be an epidemic, if you will, cigarettes were banned. Advertising was banned on television. But in California, you can still, if you go on commercial television stations, see advertising for automobiles of every sort, which is not going to help the state's climate at all. And I'm wondering if even some kind of advertising program, if you will, around this whole issue of water and the climate needs to be done to get this out to the public. And I don't even know if there's enough time to do that. So I'd like to hear them talk about, what kind of time frame they're talking about here.
Yeah. Thank you, Greg. Dr. Cook, will you take that first?
Yeah, climate change is going to be a kind of chronic underlying issue, right? And so, what we're really talking about is these kind of steady changes, really a trend towards kind of drier, more arid conditions over, the next several decades, within which we're going to see, kind of natural variability bouncing back and forth between, wet years and dry years. So that's the kind of horizon that we're looking at. And so, it's really about, there's no, climate change isn't pass-fail. It's not either we solve it or we don't. it's a condition that we're going to have to manage in a variety of ways. And so there's a lot of space between complete disaster on one end and kind of completely solving it on the other. And there's lots of opportunities within that space to make, you know, or at least to try to make better futures. So, you know, it's not a simple problem, and it's not something that, you know, can get solved in a year or two, but I think it's something that we can learn how to manage, you know, much better over the next several decades.
Jim, what would you add?
In the last several years, since I started working on these stories, I've seen the reality dawning on people. Will it be enough? Will to cut way down on the water and to conserve in a bigger way? I don't know. I don't think it'll be enough for people to do much about climate change. People are too wedded to their ways of life, and it defies an easy solution. But I do think that water conservation and new sources of water, such as desalinization plants and more conservation, more recycling, I think that'll solve some of the problems in the short term. In the long term, though, it really is going to have to be a solution to climate change, not only for the mega drought in the West, but for the rest of the world. I mean, it's just at some point, hopefully, it's going to dawn on people just how serious on everybody how serious a problem this is.
Professor Lund?
California is a very dynamic place. It's, you know, throughout its history, at least the history of European settlement, it's always been very dynamic, and a lot of changes in water management over the last century and a half. So that's certainly going to continue to change, but it'll be driven more by the climate and more by the need to manage groundwater and ecosystems, and I think we're starting to see some of that. The big changes we're seeing in groundwater with Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, I think, are going to go very well with the kind of changes we need to make to prepare for climate change and to manage with changed climate. Certainly, the groundwater legislation is forcing us to be much more careful and much more explicit about how we're managing groundwater at the local level and at the regional scales. And that's going to help us all for climate change, mega drought, and everything else. It'll just make the management tighter because we need to be tighter with the scarcer resource.
I also want to ask you, Jim, maybe you can take this. Since we're talking about the increasing price for water, what is this going to mean for people who cannot afford water? You know, I also just want to say that there are people in California who still do not have access to water. We did a show about the Navajo Nation where 1 in 3 Navajo still do not have a sink. So what are your thoughts on this, Jim?
Well, I don't know. Really, it's up to cities to kind of price their water and figure out ways to maybe have a sliding scale. I know some places do. The more you use, the more you pay to encourage conservation. But as far as pricing water for low-income people, I don't know if there is a solution for that. I don't know if cities have taken that on.
Professor Lund, what are your thoughts on this?
The biggest problems we have with water affordability and availability are for rural areas. We certainly have people in urban areas that have a hard time paying for their water bill, but that's something I think that water utilities and cities can address. But the harder problem is these very small water systems and individual wells out in rural areas that might have nitrate contamination in the groundwater, or the agriculture during the drought has pumped water to keep their trees alive and has stranded the rural drinking water wells. That's going to be a much harder problem, and part of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act should help address some of that.
Well, we're definitely going to do a show about that because Food and Water Watch has laid out a plan to upgrade water systems across the country to ensure that everyone has access to clean and safe water. And to make sure that it's very low cost. Final thoughts, Dr. Cook, on this study. What is next for this group of scientists, you obviously included, when it comes to studying these mega droughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is trying to understand, you know, what a hot drought means, right? So the other thing that makes this drought and this mega drought different than the past ones is that it's in a world that's much warmer because of climate change, and so it means that at the same time you're having a drought, you're very likely to have lots of extreme heat. And we know extreme heat beyond simply water is an added stress on vegetation and animals and people. And so, you know, a lot of what we're interested in is trying to think about how these hot droughts are likely to affect things and impact systems.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us, and we will continue, obviously, to do shows about this important issue around water because we're getting a lot of questions around this. I just want to read one comment from Christy. She says, Santa Clara County has had great success in upgrading the water treatment plant so that wastewater can be utilized by the citizenry as drinking water. A byproduct has been potable water that contains fewer contaminants than before. Thank you for that comment, Christy. We are out of time, and we'll continue doing shows around these issues. Benjamin Cook is adjunct research scientist at the Earth Institute's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia and co-author of the study. Jay Lund is professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis. Jim Robbins is a veteran journalist and author of The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. You can find resources about the show and read more articles at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with award-winning journalist Gerald Posner about his new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. As pharmaceutical giants race to create a vaccine for COVID-19, Posner says Big Pharma sees this pandemic is a once-in-a-generation business opportunity. So how can we ensure that the industry does not hike prices and restrict access for coronavirus treatments and a vaccine? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. You can also listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.